A natural disaster affects people in a different way than a man-made disaster. If it's a hurricane or a tidal wave or an earthquake, it brings people together. You're helping each other. But with the man-made disaster, this kind of disaster, you have people pulling apart. You have finger pointing. You have the haves and the have-nots. And it's very different. And so we have a two-volume set that we've published, and we've shipped them all over the world where anybody's having a man-made disaster. Well, and we've even sent it where it's a natural disaster. But it gives instruction in terms of how to be a good listener. I mean, most good psychologists really are just good listeners. And we teach people how to listen and let people talk their troubles out. But then we also have a section that talks about things like how do you deal with the press? How do you deal with the regulatory agencies? What should you be telling the person that's caused this problem? And so it's all the things that you need to know to deal with a man-made disaster. And that's been very popular, and that came out of this. And a lot of it came out of the work that PICU did in Cordova, because we had problems in Valdez, but I think Cordova had much more serious problems. They had the loss of livelihood. We had a lot of money flowing into Valdez that year. There were a lot of people that made a lot of money. And of course, you know, there was always the stories about somebody will have a $5,000 skiff, and they'd lease it, and they'd get $100,000 or more just for leasing it that summer. I mean, the money just flowed rapidly to some people, but not to others.
Right.
Now, in my case, I had a pretty nice boat, but I didn't have the nerve to lease it to Exxon because I was, I think it would have inhibited my ability to deal with them if I was receiving money from them. So I didn't do that. And I could have probably, I'm sure I made $500,000, maybe more that year on just using my boat. But I never did. And there were other people for similar reasons that didn't. And sometimes it's a little hard to be resentful or not to be resentful.
Right.
If you see your neighbor who's getting rich, renting their boat or whatever. So there was an awful lot of that. And I think maybe in terms of social problems, Valdez might have had more social problems because you had a large segment of our population which constituted the oil industry. And then the other section of our population, which were really feeling inundated and hurt by all of this.
It sounds like an overwhelmingly complicated set of dynamics. You're getting 3 hours of sleep on average that summer. Oh, I just can't imagine how you got through that time.
No, I don't either, to be honest with you. I don't remember being terribly exhausted, although I think I must have been. But I'm older now, and I couldn't do it now. But back then, of course, you were running on adrenaline. I remember a funny story. Maybe this might have been the one I was going to tell you before, and I got my mind went someplace else. But it was during this time when we were just getting these bundles of mail in, and we had to answer them. But I had one guy that kept writing to me, and he kept calling me. And at one point, I was thinking he was talking about chicken feathers, and then I read my notes, and it was duck feathers. But like the lady from Ohio that used sawdust, he was sure that bird feathers would pick up oil, and that's evidenced by the fact that we had a whole bunch of oiled birds. So he kept calling me and writing me, and I kept saying, look, you might be right, but what are you going to do? Just scatter feathers, then you got to pick up the darn feathers. And then he got back to me and he said, no, he said, I figured out a way. He said, we get this fish netting and we put the feathers inside of it and we make feather pillows. and you can throw the pillows on, and they're a lot easier to pick up. And I said, geez, I said, it might be a great idea, but I said, the mayor's office really isn't in charge of this. This isn't, well, can't you help me with Exxon or with the federal government? And I kept saying, look, you know, right now, I'm fighting with all those guys, and I don't think you want my help. So one night, that summer, I ate over here at Mike's. I don't know if you've been around enough to, but Mike's is an Italian restaurant. Mike's Greek, but runs an Italian restaurant like most Greeks. Mike's is a good place to eat, and it was open until late, and I'd go in there, and he billed me monthly because I ate there so much. He just sent me a monthly bill for. So I was in there, almost quitting time, and there's a lot of reporters in there at the time because everybody was just, you know, you just didn't get dinner until 10 or 11 o'clock at night those days. And I'm sitting there eating, and I remember I had a big plate of spaghetti, and I'm sure I had a nice glass of wine, and in walks a guy, and I see he's got a pillow full of feathers. I think, Jesus, I know who this guy is. This has got to be my correspondent. And so he's walking around. Somebody had told him, oh, yeah, Devin's eats over at Mike's every night. And so he got in there, and he asked a few people, and they pointed at me, and I thought, oh, God. Comes over, flops that feather pillow down in front of me. I have duck feathers falling all over my spaghetti. And he sets in, you've got to help me. I know this is going to work. I said, you've got to believe me. I can't. There's nothing I can do to help you. You're going to have to go see the Coast Guard and go see Exxon. And I gave him the names of the people. But I said, they're so mad at me right now. I said, if I say anything in your favor, it's going to hurt you. It's not going to help you.
Well, you're telling that anecdote makes me think of something that in all of the other interviews that I've done, of course, the oil spill has a huge impact on people's lives, et cetera. But in your case, it seems to me like you literally couldn't get away from it.
No.
I mean, that's almost mind-boggling to think that there would be a topic so dominating that you couldn't even go have a meal without having people ask you questions, and you're the spokesperson for the community, so they think that you...
No, it was the whole summer. It was just the whole summer. I'd wake up at 5 or 6 in the morning. Some nights, in fact, looking at my notes, I realized that there were nights when I would have to stay up until 3 so that I could record for East Coast Talk Television. And then I'd be back up by 5 or 6 because there were meetings that I had to go to. And it was just constant that way. I mean, it was the whole summer was... Everybody wanted a piece of your time. I had my office was at the college, and my secretary, and thank goodness, I mean, Karen was a good, tough lady that she could draw the line, but she would have to head the press off because they would be standing outside my office clamoring to get, I mean, it was like you'd see on television. Some of those shows are not exaggerating at all. There would be literally dozens of press, and I had to prioritize it. I said, if the local media, that would be the local public radio or the local radio station or the local newspaper, wants to talk to me, I said, make time. That's important. I need to talk to them. And I said, the next priority would be statewide. And then I said, national. And the lower priority is the international, because I said, I have a responsibility to this community and to this state before I do to the world. But you had German and French and British, and the world's media were here. And I remember talking to the city council saying, gee, do you think we can keep this alive for till the end of the week? Well, that was no problem. It was alive until well into September.
And then September was just the end date for the cleanup. For that year.
Well, and that was kind of a sad thing for a lot of people. I remember spending a lot of time talking on radio and television, trying to warn them as the summer wore on that, hey guys, come September, this is over. They're not going to come back next year. Now, the industry didn't want to say that. But, I mean, Exxon implied that, oh, yeah, they were going to be here until it was all cleaned up. But we had, actually, we had gotten somebody had leaked an internal memo, and we could see that, no, they were shutting down. They were going away. And so, but you had people that, you know, it was so lucrative for some of the boat owners that you had people going out and buying extra boats because I guess they thought it was going to be a lifetime occupation for them. And so after, you know, a couple of years, there were a lot of boats for sale because people had bought boats in anticipation of this. So we used the media very, very well in terms of trying to warn people. The other one was early, very early in the spill. Both the state and the federal health agencies came out with the dumbest thing I had ever heard. It was called the Sea Smell and Taste Test. So for our subsistence users, they were telling them, if you can't see, smell, or taste oil, then it's safe to eat. And as soon as I heard this, then I got on radio and television and also some of the print media and said, this makes absolutely no sense at all. We know there are lots of harmful elements that you can't see, smell, or taste. And then it was later that they decided that, yeah, they had made a mistake and that the food needed to be tested before you knew it was safe to eat. Another one was incinerators are regulated by the tonnage. And if you want to get in under the regulation, then you have a smaller incinerator. So they wanted to set 3 incinerators up here in Valdez to burn the oily, the absorbent materials, the booming material that wasn't any good anymore, and that sort of thing. Well, the dead critters. So they put 3 incinerators in, and we knew at the time what they were trying to get away with. They didn't want to have to go through any of the regulations or permitting. And I was a little annoyed about it, but it was mainly that I'm thinking, well, this is kind of a bowl, and you know, you're going to end up with smoke, and it's not going to smell very good. Until Greenpeace called me, and they wanted me to co-sponsor an article that they were doing about burning oiled items that had been soaked in seawater. The byproduct is dioxin, which is very carcinogenic. Well, at that time, with my limited popularity, at least in Valdez, I said, I don't think I want to get on the list with Greenpeace at this point, but I said, I will run this one to ground. So I called Denny Kelso, who was the commissioner of DEC at the time. I said, Denny, Greenpeace just called me, and they said, if you burn oiled stuff that's been soaked in seawater, you get dioxin as a byproduct. Do you? He said, Don, I don't know, but he said, I'll find out. Within a couple of hours, Denny called me back, and he said, John, it's true. So at that point, then we raised, again, a lot of fuss in the media about those 3 incinerators, and they took them out. But we learned to use the media extremely well.
I should think that this would be a testing ground, like you say, the first day of the oil spill, trying to contact people all around the world to figure out what to do, when in fact, that's the position that you were in and that Valdez was in, was the people to learn it so that then that knowledge could be passed on.
Well, and I'd say, you know, one of the better depository of information like that now is the RCAC website. I mean, we're trying to make all of that available. And I think, you know, Alaska as a whole has done pretty good about collecting and being able to distribute information. And certainly we got enough press on it that when there's a spill or any kind of tragedy, we will frequently get called and ask for our input and our help. And it's And if I don't know if you've ever, you probably have looked at our website, but it's a pretty intense, complete website. We've won awards for it, but it's mainly because we don't want to see anybody go through what the communities in Alaska went through. And like I say, I mean, Valdez had the impact of too many people, too much pressure. But Cordova lost their economy. I mean, Cordova really suffered. Kodiak suffered. A lot of the smaller communities, island communities, I mean, they it just changed their culture. It was just it was so hard on everybody. Valdez changed, but not drastically. Valdez is pretty much what Valdez was before the spill. We've a few more agencies. That reminds me of another interesting anecdote. I was talking about this mayor's ad hoc committee, and one of the things that came out of that meeting, besides just Ricky Ott saying it's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when, was we decided that probably we needed another DEC person in Valdez to help oversee the oil industry. A few hours later, we have the nation's largest oil spill. All hell is breaking loose. I am out at the airport waiting for Steve Cooper to come in. And the head of Alyeska is there. And he comes over and just chews me out. What do you mean you want another DEC person in this town? And I said, I don't think you've quite grasped the situation. You're going to have an awful lot more regulators in this town forevermore. I said, you just spilled an awful lot of oil. And I don't know, maybe he was in shock. But it was ludicrous to start complaining about the committee recommending that there be one more DEC person in Valdez.
Right.
But he just...
Yeah, that's pretty hard to grasp. All right.
And so we have a lot of DEC people in Valdez now.
So how safe is it for you to roam the streets of Valdez these days?
Pretty safe. I'm a fairly popular guy now. The thing happened on March 24th. March 31st is my birthday. And I was feeling a little bit down on my birthday that year. I was pretty busy. I had lots of things. I even had a meeting that went up to, I think, 9:30 or 10 o'clock. And I think, well, God, it's my birthday. I think maybe I'll go out. And I'm thinking, where can I go? Because they had these signs up, Benedict Arnold Devons, and people were threatening people's lives. Well, I don't know that I've ever had anybody threaten my life. But it was, you know, there was a lot of tension. And so I went out to one of the bars, and I walked in, and they're all applauding me. And, you know, and I thought, well, they're not all mad at me. there was a significant bunch. And then, you know, Frank Iorossi, who I said earlier, you know, seemed like a genuinely nice guy. It's not always popular in Alaska to talk about anybody in Exxon being a nice guy, but... But I liked Frank. I think he really meant to do the right thing. People were always threatening his life.
Yeah.
And I remember going on radio and saying, hey, I know you're trying to help, but this is hurting the situation. You've got to quit making these damn threats. Yeah. And then I used to think it was Stephen McAlpine that called me, but I guess looking at my notes, it was Jay Curtula, who was our senator at the time, called me and said, John, who's trying to kill the Exxon people? And I said, well, Jay, I don't know that anybody is. He said, well, they found a bomb under the stairs where their offices are. I said, I hadn't heard this. He said, let me run it to ground. I'll see what it is. Well, they had found a couple of cans of gasoline that was under the stairs, which was terribly dangerous. I mean, shouldn't be. But when we finally ran it to ground, all it was some well-meaning Exxon employee noticed that he was going to park the pickup for the night, and there was a couple of cans of gas in the back of it, and he decided that somebody was going to steal it. So he took it in the building, stuck it under the stairs. Next morning, somebody comes down and says, it's a bomb. They're going to blow us up. But I think a lot of those stories, you know, we're not basically a very violent bunch. We had an RCAC board meeting, and this would have been one of the anniversaries of the oil spill, probably the 15th. But our board meeting, and it's actually set up to coincide as close to March 24th as we can do it. And for some reason, we often have the industry, all the industries represent, all the oil industries represented. They come and keep their eye on us. But that time, there was a reason. We were meeting up in the top, well, up where Josephine's is in the Sheraton. And we were in there. And for some reason, Exxon needed to be there. One of my board members is Marilyn Heddle from Whittier. And Marilyn and Pete were both in the state troopers. Pete was very high up, and Marilyn, I think, ran the state crime lab or something. So they had a lot of inside information. And Marilyn nudged me and she said, "John, you see those two guys standing over there?" And I said, "Yeah, who are they?" She says, "Those are the security people guarding the Exxon people because Exxon's a little worried about being here." We're pretty nonviolent. But, yeah. But there was a lot of paranoia, and that was at least 15 years after.
Wow. That's some pretty amazing stuff. Mm. So, despite all of the earlier antagonisms, you stayed on. You were never tempted to leave Valdez. This is your home.
Oh no, I actually did. After the spill, I was still president of the college. I took a sabbatical, and I ran for Congress. I ran against Don Young. And I came within a couple of percentage points of beating Don, and you know, I had no money. I mean, I was all on a shoestring. My daughter, who was a teenager at the time, and Mike Pelican, who was the guy that worked for me at the college, he resigned to come and work on my campaign. He had our only computer, and Janice was out hustling what little money we had, and to come within 2% of taking Young out, it was pretty good.
I should say so.
So I went back and I continued to live in Valdez for another year, stayed at the college, and then I resigned or retired and said, "Nope, I'm going to go beat him this time." And I went back out and I was way ahead of Don right up to the final week. I mean, like 22-23% each points ahead of Don. The last minute, of course, that was the year that Clinton ran. And Alaska got very worried about Clinton, and you had all of these guys that had never voted before. Yeah. You know, when you do a poll, you're looking at likely voters, and in this case, we had a whole bunch of unlikely voters that turned up that were worried about Clinton shutting the oil industry down. And so it skewed it the other way, and I lost by 2% again.
Oh, well, maybe your time's coming up, John.
I don't think so. I think I've about done enough of that. I think Don and I think Ted are possibly vulnerable, but I don't think they're going to get beat. I don't think the state of Alaska cares if you do things that aren't entirely ethical as long as you bring the bacon home to Alaska. And
boy, whatever happened to the days of when you couldn't even have the you couldn't even have things look improper.
I agree. Well, the two times I ran against Don, there was some real interesting stuff out there. And I did better than anybody has ever done against him. But it's very difficult because there are people that are going to vote straight party line no matter what. And then others that say, well, you know, maybe he's not doing everything right, but he got us this or he got us that, he got us a bridge. And, you know, today I get along pretty well with Young. I go back to D.C., there are some that think, oh, God, he's going to hate me, but he doesn't at all. He always welcomes me in his office, and we share war stories. And if I ever end up in an event that Don's at, he invites me to come over and sit with him. And then if he gets a chance, he tells everybody that he beat me. But, but you know, there's not a lot of hard feelings there. But I look at it, I mean, there's going to be some good people that will be running against Don this time. But it's, you know, unless he and or Ted get indicted, I don't think anybody's going to beat him. I just don't see it. And I don't know if Ted gets indicted. He might still win.
Oh, heaven forbid.
Well, remember that... Mark Begich's dad, Nick Begich. Nick Begich won the election against Don Young. Nick was the incumbent. Don was running against him. Nick won that election after everybody was darn sure he was dead. You know, he and Boggs, congressman from Texas, were up here flying around. Their plane went down, we think probably out in the Gulf of Alaska. Days after they'd lost them, the election was held, and Nick still won. So it's hard to get rid of incumbents. So that'll be interesting to see what Mark Begich does.
Yeah, it surely will.
If Mark goes, he'll go against Ted, and he won't do that unless he thinks he's going to win. Mark's a pretty good politician.
Well, so in closing, are there any sentiments or thoughts that you would like to express?
I think, you know, there were a lot of good things that came out of the spill, and certainly a lot of bad things, and we suffered through those. But if we look at what we have today, we have the finest system in the world in Prince William Sound. And without the oil spill, we wouldn't have that. It's unfortunate that it takes a disaster for any real change to happen. I go all over the world now. The State Department sends me to other countries to talk to them, and they would all like to have what we have. But unless they have a disaster, a real disaster, our governments don't move on improving things. Industry doesn't move on improving things unless you've had a spill. But today we have more equipment, we have more training, we have better programs, everything is in place. And so we've made an enormous amount of progress. Our job with RCAC is to continue to demand more and better. And we do that. I know that a person with the shipping industry once said, you know, RCAC isn't hostile, but boy, are they demanding. And we're not hostile. We get along reasonably well, but we recognize that there are just going to be issues that we disagree on. We all have the same goal. Our priorities differ, but the goal is the same. Nobody wants to spill oil. And we're just not willing to take as many chances as some of industry is willing to take. But things are better today. We have better eyes keeping an eye on what's going on, better equipment. Everything has greatly improved. I don't think today you could have another accident just like the Exxon Valdez. I don't think that could happen today, because we have two tugs. One of them is tethered to the tanker. You've got all those extra sets of eyes. You got the Coast Guard with much better radar than they had back then. But there are other accidents that can happen. Certainly there are accidents on the pipeline. The pipeline's ready to have something. Mm-hmm. You've got ice that comes off the Columbia Glacier that is a real problem. And then you've got Seal Rock area and out there, and a ship loses power in a storm. We know that there is a gap problem. The gap problem is from the time they let a tanker sail, or the weather conditions when they will allow a tanker to sail, are more severe than we know we can make a save in or respond to a spill. And So that's something we're still concerned about.
Okay, well, I'll turn this off and...